Well, how can we hope for justice in a world that feels so divided? In the nations around our world, with the greatest freedoms and the least corruptions, we know that injustices remain. And Australia, you know, we can look across the Northeast, across the Pacific Ocean, we can kind of shake our heads at the ongoing struggles of that nation, the USA, which is still struggling to come to grips with its history in the transatlantic slave trade, and the ongoing kind of collective failure for it to live up to its founding document's claim that all are created equal, and that they have unalienable rights of life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. But as we look at the cries that Black Lives Matter in the United States, we know that we need to hear that here as well. That is, we need to find a way to hope for justice in a country that was founded on the utter fallacy of terra nullius. We need to hope for justice in a country where those who were here first, in so many different ways, in measures of health and education and prosperity, tend to come last. We need justice in a nation where Aboriginal people are far more likely to be victims of crime. We need justice to address the astoundingly high incarceration rates among the Indigenous community. And as I put those two statements together, the incarceration and the victims of crime, you can see just how profound and complex the justice we long for might need to be. But it's not just for those who've been here the longest. We need justice for those who are actually hoping for a better life in our modern community. We need to be a haven for those who are fleeing oppression, but our systems treat those who are seeking asylum in a very cruel way. Our attitudes towards migrant communities is at times welcoming, but actually quite often it's very unkind. We in Australia, we need to hope for justice right now. And I know that some in our community are despairing. We're despairing because we wonder if it could ever possibly come. We despair because we know that even if we don't know even if more progress can actually be made. And it's not surprising that we should feel that way. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his life for this movement over 50 years ago. And when he stood before a crowd of thousands at the Lincoln Memorial, he said this. He said, "We have come to cash this check, a check that will give us, upon demand, the riches of freedom and the security of justice." It's over 50 years ago, and it still doesn't feel like it's happened. So it's not surprising if people start to wonder if justice will ever come, whether there will be justice in this world. How can victims ever get what they deserve? How will perpetrators? And as I speak into this moment in our world, I want to confess that, you know, I'm obviously not someone who has actually suffered the injustice of bigotry or faced a system of cultural biases that have made it difficult for me to function in life. I'm male and middle class and white, and so I don't have the resources to speak about what it means to face those difficulties. But what I do, however, is to speak about how I believe, how Christians believe, the Bible can offer us a hope for justice through Jesus. Now, that may or may not be something that entices you or people you know. But even if it's not something that you're particularly interested in, I want you to stay with me because I think that there are a few things going on here that are really useful for us. I think there's three reasons that the Christian hope for justice is worth hearing. The first is because there is a hope that we need. That is, if we're going to keep working for justice in this world, we need some hope that things can and will be better. We need some kind of hope that gives confidence that all of this is heading somewhere and means something. Secondly, I think this is worth hearing because what I'm going to describe is a hope that has a long history in working for justice in this world. It's the one that Martin Luther King Jr. shared, along with many of those others who were in that civil rights movement in the United States. Also, leaders of the Australian civil rights movements like Sir Doug Nicholls. And going back further, it's the work of those people who were the abolitionists like Wilberforce and Wedgwood. Those who have this hope still work with those who don't have it. We still want to see justice grow, but this Christian hope has shaped the movement for justice in our world. And thirdly, I think that this hope gives us a confident hope. That is, it can have a significant, and it's one that can have a significant impact on us right now. So it's not just dreamed up, and it's not just something for sort of post-life. No, it has foundations in the real historical action of Jesus, and so it's dependable. But it's also effective for our lives now, not just for the future. It can be lived out in the present time. So let's think about it. I'm going to start with a bit of a longer quote from Dr. King. He said this, "I have a dream that one day, right there in Alabama, little black boys and little black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted and every hill and mountain shall be made low, and the rough places will be made a plain and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together." As Dr. King was encouraging those crowds to keep pursuing the cause of racial justice, he recalls the promise of an ancient Jewish prophet. He quotes from Isaiah chapter 40. It's the passage we had read for us. In its context, it's a passage that would bring an end to the suffering and condemnation of the people of Israel. God was promising there would be relief for those who trusted him. He would bring an end to the pain and the suffering of his people. But I want to point out that as much as this is a call to act with that goal in mind, it's not actually something that the prophet ever expected humans to bring. For immediately after those verses, the prophet is told to declare, "All people are like grass, and their faithfulness is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers and the flowers fall because the breath of the Lord blows on them. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers and the flowers fall, but the word of our God endures forever." See, the confidence doesn't come from humans. How could it? We're far too weak to see the changes we long for. We're far too selfish and self-interested to ever see the fullness of this vision. We know that the deep problems in our world are not just out there, but also in here. All too often, the people we love the most, the people we know we should care for, they're the ones who bear the brunt of our own personal brands of injustice. What I mean is that we all have our own personal mix of selfishness and greediness and anger and lust. And it's not to say that everything we do is always wrong all of the time. No, of course humans are capable of impressive acts of grace and kindness. But we can't, ultimately, do all of the good things we should do all of the time. Each one of us, in and of ourselves, will fail in all kinds of way to be truly loving and kind. And the systems and structures of our community, since they are the outworking of us as a collective, likewise will have all kinds of faults and failings built into them. And so all of us personally and collectively, we are unable to make that dream for justice a reality, even when we really want it. And of course, often we don't want it. No, we will ignore it or we'll reject it instead. But while people and their promises fail, the word of God promises to last forever. And it's that confidence in God that Christians believe finds its fulfillment in Jesus. For in Jesus, it wasn't simply a human coming to try to fix some of our problems. No, we believe that it was God himself coming into history to solve the deepest problems, all of the issues of humanity. Luke, the historian who wrote the third book in the New Testament, which records the life of Jesus, we're picking up the story where Jesus begins his public ministry. As Jesus takes the scroll of Isaiah, it's from the part we just read, and he reads a section from Isaiah, which is later in the book than what we were reading, Isaiah 40. Jesus is going to pick up the story from Isaiah 61. But listen to what happens again. Because Jesus went into Nazareth, this is verse 16. where he had been brought up. And on the Sabbath day, he went into the synagogue, as was his custom, and he stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. And unrolling it, he found a place where it is written, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, the recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Then he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. The eyes of everyone on the synagogue were fastened on him, and he began by saying to them, "Today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." Christians believe that in Jesus, God was coming to bring all of our hopes and desires for justice. He was coming to deal with all of our faults and our failings. See, Jesus was very real about our problem. He proclaimed very clearly what God expected of humanity, to love God, the one who's made us with all of our heart, our soul, our mind and strength, and to love our neighbour, those around us, even if that neighbour is an enemy, to love them as we love ourselves. But he knew that humans failed to live up to that standard. He knew, most of all, that it was those who thought that they had it all worked out, that they were doing really well, that they were in the worst position of all. Because while they might be doing many good things, they don't count for anything without the humility to say that they too are in need of forgiveness. And so here's the conundrum that Jesus faced, indeed that God faced in sending Jesus. How can he bring God's justice when in reality the only justice that humanity deserves, that any of us deserve, is condemnation? That is, while we might be in some respects better or worse than others, all of us have done wrong. How could Jesus bring the kind of positive justice and peace that we hope for without bringing the negative justice, the condemnation that we fear? Well, in his kindness, God decided that he would offer a kind of amnesty in Jesus, a way for people to find forgiveness for their wrongdoing. Entirely undeserved, Jesus began to speak up and offer forgiveness. He would cancel the debt that we owe for the wrong that we've done. And that is great news. But how can the God of justice allow the guilty to go free? Think about this, because it really is scandalous. We might think in particular we could pick someone particularly bad from history. Anyone here familiar with Godwin's Law? We're not going to pick a Nazi. We're not going to pick Hitler. We'll go with a slaver instead. That's Godwin's Law. You're not allowed to sort of jump to Nazis as the main way to discuss ethics, but that's all right. Let's go with a slaver, okay? You know, one of those people that would captain ships, take people from Africa to the USA. How can one of those people find forgiveness? Because it doesn't seem like it should just be as simple as coming to Jesus, trusting him, asking him for forgiveness and receiving it. And yet, it happens. It happened. You know, one such person was John Newton. How can God save a person like John Newton? Well, if you don't know who John Newton is, you might remember those memorial services that were held for George Floyd. And when I listened to them on the radio, they had coverage of it. And at every time they had the coverage of it, they had the song Amazing Grace. John Newton wrote the song Amazing Grace. Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. That song was written by a man who was a former slaver about the simplicity of the forgiveness available in Jesus. And I think that we all need hope that we can be forgiven for what we've done wrong. That in our very core, right in our hearts, where we know that we are wretches, that we are blind, that we are lost, we need something to cleanse us and change us. But it's scandalous, isn't it, that God should forgive a wretch like John Newton? None of his remorse made up for what he'd done. None of his campaigning to end the slave trade made up for those people whom he killed. None of what he did made up for those whom he'd sinned against, or made up for what he'd done against the God who made and loved every single one of those people. And yet he confessed his sin and was forgiven. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. And I think playing that song at the memorial of George Floyd, I believe, just demonstrates just how wide that desire is, that this is what everybody wants. But how can God declare an amnesty? Won't he make sure that the debts of wrong are paid? Well, he did, and he will. Jesus makes an amnesty possible by taking on himself all of the wrongdoing that we deserve. The Bible describes Jesus' death as a sacrifice and a swap. He dies instead of me. He gives his good life for mine. And he takes away all of God's righteous anger and condemnation on himself. In God, Christ reconciles the world to himself. And this amnesty, this is free and it's available to everyone who will trust in Jesus. But it can only last so long because there is a time coming when God will again send Jesus to this world to make it the way it's always supposed to have been. See, the beginnings of the justice has come in Jesus, but there's more still to come. On that day, all of the good things in this world will be restored. There will be peace and justice for all. It's not just that there won't be crime and there won't be war. No, there will be the amplification and the extension of all the positive aspects of our world. The hungry will be fed. The humble will be lifted up. But this is also a warning, because in that future, the promised amnesty will end. There is a promise to the end of all kinds of evil. And if you don't take up this offer of amnesty that exists now, if you continue in your rejection of God, if you fail to respond to his grace and kindness, whether that's an active rebellion or just a passive one where you just ignore it, the Bible says you're not going to receive this glorious kingdom that he is bringing. Instead, you'll have to bear the weight of your own wrongdoing and sin. And that is severe. And you might say that it's not fair in some way, but that is the Bible's promise, a fair and equitable justice measured out. God is going to test our hearts. No one will miss out. The Bible calls us to ask, where will you stand on that final day? But my point here is that the hope for justice in Christianity looks back to the cross of Jesus as the place where we can find forgiveness and renewal and safety, and it looks forward to the kingdom that he is going to bring, where there will be a full and final reckoning. A new age where all people, people of every tribe and nation and tongue, can come together in unity before the God who made us all. That is what the picture, which we're not going to go into depth in Revelation chapter 7, is speaking about. Now, I'm not going to try and capture all the aspects of how this hope should impact the life of Christians. But let me pick up on a few of them. What I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about some of these things, and then we're going to have a little break. We're going to pray about them. And then we'll have some questions and comments. So Christian hope for justice looks back to the cross, and it looks forward to that picture we read about in Revelation chapter 7, where all nations gather around the throne. So let's see what the difference that Jesus makes here. So Christian hope firstly demands that Christians, like Christ himself, don't act to preserve themselves and their privilege, but rather give up their lives for each other and for their neighbours. Now, I'm not going to for one moment suggest that Christians are incredibly good at doing this. No, we fail in all sorts of ways as individuals, as churches. But this is what we're meant to be like. We're meant to be like Christ, the one who didn't come to be served, but to serve. The God of Christianity doesn't use his strength and privilege to lord it over us, but he stoops and he serves and he slaves for us. We should desire and work towards being people like that, if we have this hope. And in fact, we have many more resources, do you see, to do that truly and lovingly and deeply than many in our world. Again, I'm not going to say that we do this particularly well, but we should. After all, we not only have Christ's example and his directives to be like this, But we also have a position of confidence. You see, we have nothing to lose, but Christ has died for us. He's given his all for us, and he has guaranteed this new future. So there's actually no risk if we are to give our lives for other people. We can put ourselves even in harm's way for the sake of others. And there's lots of Christians who have done that. And moreover, there's no place for us ever becoming kind of arrogant as we seek to do this. We can't look down our noses at the unenlightened. No, because we know the depths of our faults and failings. We know that God had to send Jesus to deal with those things. We know it's only God's grace that's going to change us. And so the Christian hope, you see, doesn't just call us to check our privilege, but actually to give up our privilege for the sake of others. It encourages and enables us to love even our enemies, to pray for those who persecute you. So that's the first thing, a personal self-sacrifice is grounded in this hope. Secondly, this hope recognizes and gives grounding for the value and unity and dignity of all people. It says we're all made by one God. It says we're all part of one human family. We're even made in the image of God. It says we are equally in need of salvation. Not that we all commit the same wrongs, but that all of us do wrong and need a way out. It says that we're all going to stand before God and give an account for what we've done. And all that does is say that there's no special class of humans. There's no group who's better or worse than others, who deserve more or less. Now, Christianity is not a thing for white people. And unfortunately, lots of Christians still need to hear this. And in fact, we can see that it's not if we look from a global perspective at our world. Christianity began in the Middle East. Today, it's about a quarter of the world's population who identify as Christians live in Europe. There's a quarter who are in sub-Saharan Africa. There's about a third in the Americas, about 13%, and this is starting to grow in Eastern Asia. See, the typical Christian is not a white, middle-aged guy, but actually a brown-skinned young woman. Christianity is more linguistically and culturally diverse than any other religion because this is something that is truly for everyone. And the final expectation of Christianity, as we heard, is one where all people, all tribes and nations and tongues are going to come together before God. So the point is that if you're a Christian, you can't see anyone as better. You can't see yourself as being better than anyone else. And you should actually say amen to the idea that black lives matter because, of course, they do matter. They matter to God. All of us matter to him. And the fact that some are being treated unfairly, that injustices of the past have not been addressed, that there are systems that continue to oppress people, those things we should be causing us to take action. And in a democracy, we are people who elect our officials. We are people who have the tools of lobbying and protesting as well. Now, where do you start? Where do you start when you want to take action on this idea that there is value and dignity to all people? Well, I want to suggest that the way you actually start is by listening and reading and learning for yourself. I think university students are often very revved up for action. They want to take action straight away. But that's actually not where we should start. We need to start by stopping and listening and learning. If you want to think about how to do that well, you could come and talk to me for some resources afterwards. But let's keep going. Thirdly, the Christian hope says, don't worry, because justice really will come. See, when progress is slow, when we're powerless to bring it, when political systems fail, when there is great moral leaders who fail us, don't despair. Don't put all the pressure on yourself or on the collective group to bring about the change. No, rest in God. When you're tired and weary, when you're weighed down by the weight of responsibility, remember the words of Jesus who said, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. Justice won't fail. God will do it. Fourthly, the Christian hope says, work for justice in the present time. We need to be working according to the pattern that Jesus has laid out. We need to work to bring the justice of that future kingdom into the present time. We need to get on board with where God is taking our world in that way. Confident that the outcome is fixed, knowing that the progress is only going to be slow in this age, but however small in the present time, we need to remember that God checks our heart. Paul, one of the apostles of Jesus, one of his representatives, wrote this. He said, "Let us not become weary in doing good, for at the proper time we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, especially to those who belong to the family of believers." So let's leave this there for now. This is the Christian hope for justice, which is found in two places particularly: the cross of Jesus, which is going to offer us amnesty for all, and the return of Jesus, which will bring it to its completion. One day every valley shall be exalted, every mountain and hill will be made low, the rough places will be made plain, the crooked places made straight, and the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and every single person will see. It will come, and until it does, we can keep on working for it.